As a poet, Ellen Bass is known for going off in different directions, but always accompanied by her wit and compassion. Born in New Jersey and educated in the Northeast during the second wave of feminism, the now longtime California resident talks about some of her endeavors today on New Letters on the Air. But first, here's a good poetic introduction to Ellen Bass.
Asking directions in Paris. Où est le boulevard Saint-Michel? You pronounce the question carefully. And when the native stops, shifting her narrow sack of wine and baguettes, lifting her manicured hand, you feel a flicker of accomplishment. But beyond that, all clarity dissolves. For the woman in the expensive shoes and suit exactly the soft gray of clouds above the cathedral does not say, to the right, to the left, straight ahead. Phrases you memorized from tapes as you drove around your hometown or mumbled into a pocket Berlitz on the plane, but relays something wholly unintelligible, some version of, on the corner he is a shop of jewels in a fountain when the hotel arrives on short feet. You listen hard, nodding as though your pleasant disposition, your willingness to go wherever she tells you, will make her next words pop up from this ocean of sound, somewhat the way a dog hears its name and the coveted syllable, walk. If you're brave enough or very nervous, you may admit you don't understand. And though evening's coming on and her family's waiting, her husband lighting another Gauloise, the children setting the table, she repeats it again. Another gesture of her lovely hand, from which you glean no more than you did the first time. And as you thank her profusely and set off full of groundless hope, you think this must be how it is with destiny, God explaining and explaining what you must do, and all you can make out is a few unconnected phrases, a word or two, a wave in what you pray is the right direction.
Asking Directions in Paris by Ellen Bass, included in her book, The Human Line, which is either her second or fifth collection, a mystery that stymied even the late former U.S. Poet Laureate Philip Levine. This 2005 New Letters Literary Prize winner for poetry came to Kansas City a second time in 2017 as a visiting poet for Hallmark when I got to talk with her in depth. I'm Angela Elam with New Letters Magazine at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, and here's part one of our conversation.
I was really puzzled because the blurbs on the books, one of them says, The Human Line is Ellen Bass's sixth collection of poetry. And then on your most recent book, the 2014 Like a Beggar, it says, in her third collection of poetry, Like a Beggar. I'm like, wait a minute, these both are coming from Copper Canyon. What the heck is going on? And I knew that you had written some earlier books, so I was trying to figure it out. And then I ran across a really wonderfully written piece in The Rumpus by Ellen Brown called In Plain Sight, The Vanishing of Ellen Bass. And it sort of answered the question for me, but why don't you talk about that a little bit? Why it's six and one and three in the later?
Sure. That's a very valid confusion. The kind of basic thing is that I started writing and publishing books of poetry very young, in my early 20s. And then I taught creative writing workshops for women. And in those workshops, women began to write about child sexual abuse. And this was stunning and deeply disturbing to me. And I was so devastated and also so admiring of these women who had such strength and such beauty after going through these deeply violating experiences. And I was not a survivor myself, but I felt like it was really important for people to know about this. This was way back as well. So I got together with some other women and we published the anthology, I Never Told Anyone, of women's stories. And that led me into hearing more and more from women and the deep need not just to tell their stories, but to have a safe place to begin to heal. And so I started leading workshops called I Never Told Anyone, using writing not as a way to do publishable writing necessarily or creative writing, but just as a healing tool. And through that, learned an enormous amount about what was helpful in the healing process. And that led eventually to Laura Davis and I teaming up to co-author The Courage to Heal. And all of that was the most deeply gratifying and important work that I feel very, very privileged, honored to have had the opportunity to do. But it took me away from poetry. I couldn't write my own poetry at the same time.
Well, you were so focused on the nonfiction involved with helping others to heal through poetry.
Exactly. Right. And so after about a dozen years in that work, I felt like I had to return to poetry and that my own little spirit needed to be fed again through my own writing of poetry. And that's when I returned. So I have a kind of second incarnation. And so sometimes I don't really encourage people to read those early books because they're really not so good. But I have three books since my return to poetry. And that's why it says
six on one,
and now it says three, just kind of focusing on the books since my return.
And we should mention the three books are Mules of Love from Boa Editions, and then The Human Line and Like a Beggar, both from Copper Canyon. There are so many poems about your mother and dealing with aging parents, including your father, and having to watch them leave this world and go into the next. But, you know, there's such a tenderness at that time of life that I think you capture really well. And your parents seem like, from other poems I've read, such stalwart people. And yet, in these moments, you're really close to them. There's that touching physical and emotional that goes on that is so powerful.
Thank you. I've continued to write more about my father and my mother especially since these two books as well. And I feel like I just never want to stop writing about them. I would have thought when I was younger that I didn't have that much to say. But it's really interesting to me how much I keep wanting to return to both of them and to the liquor store where they worked. And we lived in an apartment over the liquor store. And when I was growing up, our life seemed to me the most mundane, pedestrian, unpoetic world you could possibly live in. And I can't believe how rich a field it is, mining it, you know, digging deeper and deeper into it. It seems endlessly rich. And I'm kind of fascinated by my own fascination, you know, that this should continue to grab me more strongly as I get older rather than less.
There's a poem in The Human Line. It's called My Father's Day. And this one has more to do with your father, but it kind of gives some insight into the life.
My Father's Day begins with my mother pulling him out of bed. And if he cries out and she falters, he insists, pull harder. But by breakfast, he looks like an ordinary father. Thick, wavy hair parted in the middle, reading the Pleasantville Press, except for the stiff beige brace that clasps his neck. He's stirring four sugars into his cup. On a better day, he might bestow a hint of smile, quip, I like a little coffee in my sugar. But this morning he's silent as he heads down the stairs, always reaching up two fingers to tap the overhang. Superstition, or just to make sure he still can. At 9, the drunks are already waiting. What's the word, Thunderbird? What's the price? 30 twice. He slips half pints of blackberry brandy into slim brown bags, hefts cases of Pabst onto the counter. His spine is fused into a deep curve, neck locked down, so he has to tip back on his heels to look you in the face. Before dinner, my father is supposed to sit in the closet, his chin in a canvas sling, hooked up to ropes and pulleys. Instead, he wolfs down a sandwich and rumbles back to the store. At 10, they collect the change fund from the driver, deadbolt the doors. Is this yours? He asks me, holding up a school book. What he means is, put it away. My mother cooks him oatmeal, and they watch Jack Parr. Then he climbs into her twin bed. He always had strength for that, my mother told me in a crowded aisle of the grocery store the day after his funeral. I'd never even seen them kiss or hold hands. But then she spilled everything. She couldn't stop talking, as though the angel of death, in departing, unlocks the jaws of the bereaved.
My Father's Day, from the collection The Human Line by Ellen Bass, who's with me today here on New Letters on the Air. I can see why it would be fascinating, because I think a lot of our childhood, we take for granted what we see on an everyday occasion.
Yes.
And then when you've lost it, it yes. begins to return to you and you realize the significance of it. Were you an only child, or did you have siblings?
I have a sibling, a brother, but he's 8 years older. And he was a little bit of a father as well as a brother, because my father was so ill. And
did your father have scoliosis? Or
he had rheumatoid arthritis.
Ooh.
And after he died, my mother said, you know, none of us ever really took in how strong he was to carry on the way he did. We noticed his irritability and things like that, but it was only after he died, I think, that we all gave him the respect that he was really due.
Yeah. You've been published in a lot of literary magazines, including New Letters, and you've published in The New Yorker several times. There's a great story floating out there that I want you to tell me, because the New Yorker started doing these podcasts, and they would get poets in there to talk about things that had been published in the magazine. And it turned out to be Philip Levine.
Yes.
Using your
yes.
poem, unbeknownst to you.
Yeah, unbeknownst.
Tell us about that experience.
Well, it was the first New Yorker podcast. It was in the morning, and I was in the living room in my pajamas and opened up my email, and one of my students sent me an email, and she said, Philip Levine is reading and talking about your poem on the New Yorker podcast. And I thought it was a joke. I thought she was just fooling around with me. And I went to it, and, you know, it starts out, and still there's this feeling of unreality. Could she have, like, cooked this up? Or is everyone going to start laughing in a minute, you know, that this is not real? And I just listened to it, and I just sat there immobilized, and my wife came in, and I said, sit down, you have to listen to this. And I said to her, you know, I hope this isn't the last good thing that happens to me in poetry. But if it is, I could die happy. Yeah, it was just the pinnacle of acknowledgement that I never imagined yeah. could be, because, of course, Phil Levine is just the most amazing poet.
Well, he's every man's poet.
Every
you know,
man's
so.
Poet. You know, for him, with his poems that he has given us and his sensibility, that he would choose that poem among all the New Yorker poems he could have chosen to admire and talk about, just knocked me out.
Well, of course, we've got to hear this poem. It's a little bit long, but I think we need to hear it.
Good. He reads it much more dramatically than I ever could. It's called What Did I Love? And the background is that my wife and I became increasingly concerned about the ways in which the animals that we eat for meat are raised. And we started to do a lot of research. We live in Santa Cruz, California, where you would think it would be relatively more easy to get animals that were sustainably raised. But the more research we did, the harder it was to find conditions that we felt were really satisfactory. It is changing now, but this was written a few years back. And we were getting a little discouraged. And just then, some young friends of ours mentioned that they were raising chickens, not commercially, just on their land, and that they could raise some for us if we wanted, and then we could just buy them from them. And we were thrilled with this. And so we said, yes, that was great. And then 3 months later, they called us and said that the chickens were ready to be killed, and did we want to help? And I said, yes, because I felt that if I was going to eat something, I wanted to be willing to kill it and to understand what it was that I was doing, and not pretend that meat came in little plastic packages. So I didn't grow up on a farm. I'd never seen my mother or grandmother killing chickens. And so this was very new experience for me. And afterward, it stayed with me so deeply, the experience, that I felt that I needed to explore it in a poem. So this is my exploration of the experience. What did I love? What did I love about killing the chickens? Let me start with the drive to the farm as darkness was sinking back into the earth, the road damp and shining like the snail's silver ribbon, and the orchard with its bony branches. I loved the yellow rubber aprons and the way Janet knotted my broken strap and the stainless steel altars we bleached, Brian sharpening the knives, testing the edge on his thumbnail. All 88 Cornish hens huddled in their crates, wrapping my palms around their white wings, lowering them into the tapered urn. Some seemed unwitting as the world narrowed. Some cackled and fluttered. Some struggled. I gathered each one, tucked her bright feet, drew her head through the kill cone's sharp collar. Her keratin beak and the rumpled red vascular comb that once kept her cool as she pecked in her mansion of grass. I didn't look into those stone eyes. I didn't ask forgiveness. I slid the blade between the feathers and made quick crescent cuts, severing the arteries just under the jaw, blood like liquor pouring out of the bottle. When I see the nub of heart later, it's hard to believe such a small star could flare like that. I lifted each body, bathing it in heated water, until the scaly membrane of the shanks sloughed off under my thumb. And after they were tossed in the large plucking drum, I loved the newly naked birds, sundering the heads and feet neatly at the joints, a poor man's riches for golden stock, slitting a fissure, reaching into the chamber, freeing the organs, the spill of intestines, blue-tinged gizzard, the small purses of lungs, the royal hearts, easing the floppy liver carefully from the green gall bladder, its bitter bile, and the fascia unfurling like a transparent fan. When I tug the esophagus down through the neck, I love the suck and release as it lets go, then slicing off the anus with its gray pearl of sh**. Over and over, my hands explore each cave, learning to see with my fingertips, like a traveler in a foreign country, entering church after church. In every one, the same figures of the Madonna, Christ on the cross, which I'd always thought was gore, until Marie said to her it was tender, the most tender image. Every saint and political prisoner, every jailed poet and burning monk. But though I have all the time in the world to think thoughts like this, I don't. I'm empty as I rinse each carcass, and this is what I love most. It's like when the refrigerator turns off and you hear the silence. As the sun rose higher, we shed our sweatshirts and moved the coolers into the shade. But other than that, no time passed. I didn't get hungry. I didn't want to stop. I was breathing from some bright reserve. We twisted each pullet into plastic, iced and loaded them in the cars. I loved the truth, even in just this one thing, looking straight at the terrible, one-sided accord we make with the living of this world. At the end, we scoured the tables, hosed the dried blood, the stain blossoming through the water.
The poem, What Did I Love? It's from Ellen Bass's book, Like a Beggar, and it was chosen by Philip Levine for The New Yorker's first ever podcast about poetry.
The other thing that I thought was fascinating was that he had known of my work way back in the 70s, but then not about my return to poetry at all. And he talks about this. He says, you know, I don't know where she's been. And I just love that because he assumed that I did this regularly and for work. And that was very moving to me, that he saw it in a context that was very different from, you know, my actual experience, and that he imagined that somebody might be able to do this every day and be this deeply connected to the experience really struck me very profoundly.
I can see why Philip Levine chose this one, because the language in it is so gorgeous.
Thank you.
And yet you're describing killing, and I don't know, the juxtaposition of the two is pretty amazing.
Thank you. When I wrote this poem, I knew that I was up against one obvious challenge, which is that I didn't want it to sound like instructions for killing a chicken. First we did this, then we did this, then we did that. And I don't feel that sound is my strongest suit. So I thought, I'm going to have to really think about sound much more consciously in this poem. And Dorian Lux had written some poems in her last book, The Book of Men, in which all the lines ended with the same consonant. I thought that was really neat. And maybe a year or two before I wrote this poem, I had tried to do that in another poem that failed. But I had worked very hard on that poem before it failed. And unbeknownst to me, I was in that work teaching myself how to think about those end consonants differently. And so in this poem, I decided to use R. And my rule for myself was that it didn't have to be at the end of the word, but it had to be in the final word. And so if you look at it on the page, you'll see there's a few exceptions because at the last 11th hour, some of the line breaks were just a little too wonky and I changed them. But there's R's in all the final words of the lines and a lot of R's in the poem. And so I thought that that sound could be a kind of oral glue that would help the poem come together. And I did work really hard on the language. It was very joyful work of just really trying to make each word in the language, both the meaning and the sound, come together so that it could not be a recipe.
Oh, interesting that you should choose R, because that's such a big part of the growl. And here's one animal killing other animals, you know?
Oh, my goodness. I never thought of that. That's so interesting. I chose it originally, you know, from the top 1% of my mind where, you know, we often operate, you know, because my opening lines had a lot of R's in them. Just in my first draft, I had written, let me start with the drive to the farm is darkness, you know, so they had these kind of R's. And then I thought, well, R is also a common sound. I wasn't going to choose a K or something difficult. So interesting that you say the growl, because of course, but I had been seeing it as a sort of soft sound, an R, you know, as opposed to a harsh, like a P or something. But wow, the growl. Yeah.
Because a growl could be soft, too.
It could be, but it is a growl. I never thought of it. I'm so glad you said that. It gives me insight into my own thinking.
Well, I want to have you read something that has a completely different feel to it. I love the opening poem of this book, Like a Beggar, Relax.
I wrote it, but it's a teaching poem for me. And
do you mean by that, teaching poem?
You know, of course I don't go around through my life with the right attitude. And so I need to be told over and over that, you know, I should relax and that bad things are going to happen and that in the midst of all of that, we have to savor the moment. And I forget that dozens of times a day and sometimes in important ways. So this poem really reminds me. And my son's grown now. He's almost 30 and he's living with us for a little while he goes to grad school. And I was talking to him on the phone not long ago and he had just a really bad day. He was farming and the tractor broke and, you know, and a couple other things like that. And I said, "Oh, honey, I'm so sorry." And he said, "Bad things are going to happen." So we all use relax in the family now when we can.
You're celebrating all of life. It's
yes.
a very Zen look at life.
Yes.
You know, you take the yin and the yang, the good and the bad, the whole of it, and
yes.
go forth.
We kind of have to or be fighting against it all the time. And of course, I fight against it just like everybody else. But it's good to have a kind of compass, you know, that reminds you that even while you're fighting, that this is it. This is the whole of the human experience. Relax. Bad things are going to happen. Your tomatoes will grow a fungus and your cat will get run over. Someone will leave the bag with the ice cream melting in the car and throw your blue cashmere sweater in the dryer. Your husband will sleep with a girl your daughter's age, her breasts spilling out of her blouse. Or your wife will remember she's a lesbian and leave you for the woman next door. The other cat, the one you never really liked, will contract a disease that requires you to pry open its feverish mouth every 4 hours. Your parents will die. No matter how many vitamins you take, how much Pilates, you'll lose your keys, your hair, and your memory. If your daughter doesn't plug her heart into every live socket she passes, you'll come home to find your son has emptied the refrigerator, dragged it to the curb, and called the used appliance store for a pickup, drug money. The Buddha tells a story of a woman chased by a tiger. When she comes to a cliff, she sees a sturdy vine and climbs halfway down. But there's also a tiger below, and two mice, one white, one black, scurry out and begin to gnaw at the vine. At this point, she notices a wild strawberry growing from a crevice. She looks up, down, at the mice. Then she eats the strawberry. So here's the view, the breeze, the pulse in your throat. Your wallet will be stolen. You'll get fat. Slip on the bathroom tiles in a foreign hotel and crack your hip. You'll be lonely. Oh, taste how sweet and tart the red juice is. How the tiny seeds crunch between your teeth.
Relax, from Like a Beggar by Ellen Bass. For links, visit newletters.org, where you can sign up for a free weekly podcast so you won't miss part two of this conversation, or keep up through Facebook and Twitter. From New Letters Magazine at UMKC, today's show was produced with Danny Reeves, Timothy Larrison, Marissa Reddick, Cedric Hurt, Dylan Cramhorn, and Jamie Walsh. I'm Angela Elam for New Letters on the Air.